how to derive the equations of motion, how to enlarge the configuration space into the phase space. We discussed very nice structure of the Poisson brackets. We discussed the freedom of the Hamiltonian dynamics, which is encoded in canonical transformations. And really, you know, employing these canonical transformations, you can start producing very nice formulations of Hamiltonian mechanics. And one of them is the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. So what I would like to do today is to start discussing symmetries. We already understand symmetries in Lagrangian picture. In the Hamiltonian picture, even more beautiful and nicer. So it's part A, B, C, D, E. Symmetries. And of course, this can be discussed without any geometrical insight, but let me just try to put some geometrical insight into this. So we already know that we have a structure of Poisson bracket. Okay, so we already know that, you know, that the phase space can be equipped with this structure of Poisson brackets. And so this can be used to actually start thinking geometrically about various things. In particular, we know that if we have a phase space function f, well, what we could in principle do is that we could assign to it the corresponding operator, which would be defined by your Poisson bracket, where we leave the first slot open, and we just feed in f into the second slot of the Poisson bracket. So if you remember our definition of the Poisson bracket in terms of canonical coordinates, it's always d of the first slot over dq, d of the second slot over dp, and so on. So what this is equal to is df over dpi, d over dqi. I left the first slot open. And then minus df over dqi, d over dpi. Right? And so I just left the first slot open, and I understand this as a differential operator. Okay, so this is a differential operator. But of course, differential operators are super nice, right? Because if you think about them, like, you know, they live in a vector space, and so they actually represent vectors in that vector space. And so what does it mean is that, you know, this thing here tells me, well, I'm moving in the q direction, and this thing over here, which is like the component of the vector, tells me how much you move in that direction, right? And similarly, this thing here over, so now we live in the phase space, so there's also the p direction, and this thing here tells me, well, how much you move in that p direction. So these things are components of a vector. And the same thing, of course, here is the minus sign. And this thing here is just a base of the vector, or, you know, basis of the vector, basis of the vector. And the same thing here. So in other words, you know, I define two. Every phase space function, I can either think about that the Poisson bracket allows me to define a differential operator, or it actually allows me to form a vector field, XF. Oh, okay, so this is, you know, this is the same thing as that you define a vector field. And then vector field will have some components, xaf, d over dxa. So again, these are the components. This is the basis. And it's precisely given by this thing over here. So, okay, so that's equal to that. So in other words, what it means is that now we have coordinates xa, well, to be qi and pi. And the components of this vector f, xaf, to be this thing here. So with respect to qi, is this thing here. With respect to pi, is the thing here. So it's df over dpi, and then minus df over dqi. Yes?
Just notationally, which x's are capital and which ones are lowercase?
So here, this guy is a vector, okay? Xf is a vector. So now components of the vector typically have some index, right? So I put an index a, and this index a runs from 1 to 2n, right? So we have not only coordinates, but we also have the momenta, right? So this index a runs from 1 to 2n, and it runs over, if you want, the coordinates which are at our disposal, which are q and p. So these are the coordinates which we are using. And then, you know, if you write it down, it is this expression over here, and the components are like that.
Sorry, but are these all capital X's or? Something?
These are all capital X's in the yeah. So you know, yeah.
Why is it 2n and not just n?
Oh, because I'm including. So remember, you live on the phase space, right? So you include not only the q directions, this n of q directions, right? But you also have the directions p, and there's another n.
But we have two variables per I, so with a running from a to n, we will not have two n variables. Correct?
Oh, so you have n of those, right? You have n of those, and then is another n of these,
mm-hmm. So
right?
I think the point is, if we're writing it as qi, comma pi, it should only run up to n, because each of the q's and each of the p's only run up to n.
Yeah. Okay. Let me change the index. Would you be happy more like that, BJ? Okay. Okay. Everybody happy now?
Actually, I don't think that's still correct, because I think the whole point is that the q's by themselves only run up to n, and
yeah,
the q's by themselves only run up to n. So
yeah.
If you write xa in that manner, then a can only run up to n. That's the way I understood that.
No, here we'd have.
Well,
you coupled one of the q's with one of the
q's.
Yeah.
This is not good, okay? So it's not a Poisson bracket between the two, right? So it's just I'm enumerating my coordinates. I have q1, q2, q3, q5, q10, p1, p2, p3, p5, p10, right? So it's not a. This is even worse, right? It's not a Poisson bracket, right? Okay. The important point is that the coordinate x includes both q and p, right? And there's 2n of those. Okay. So anyway, you know, this is amazing, right? So we can assign to a phase space function, we can assign the corresponding vector field, okay? And it precisely looks like this. This vector field, because it's generated by a phase space function, has a special name. It's called Hamiltonian vector field corresponding to the function f.
Sorry, I have a question about notation. So that xf is a constructed version of a, like the two a's contracted. Like
yes.
Why is it a vector? Because there's no index on xf.
So typically you can write a vector in the basis, right? So people write a vector. I don't know. They write the components of the vector to be v1, v2, v3, and so on, right? What do you mean by this is that, you know, this is typically in some direction x1, this corresponds to direction x2, x3, and so on. So, you know, this tells you how much you move in the direction x1, how much you move in the direction x2, and so on, right? So this is writing in terms of the components, right? But I already know what the basis is. You have to say, well, I'm working in Cartesian basis, and then these are my corresponding components of the vector, right? So now sometimes it's actually useful, you know, to carry the basis with you as well, right? And then you would write that v is v1 d over dx1, but this is a vector, and then plus v2 d over dx2, which is a vector, and so on. And so it's exactly the same thing. You're just, you know, expressing the same information differently. You are sort of carrying the basis with yourself as well. So you are saying, well, this thing here will be a vector, right? These are just the numbers. These are just the components. But the vector, of course, you know, has to be a linear combination of vectors. And these are the basis vectors. So I have a vector d over dx1 is one vector. I have a d over dx2, another vector, right? And then now my general vector v will be some linear combination of these. This is a linear combination of this vector, that vector, and so on. So this is, yeah.
So it's like a coordinate independent.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. So whereas these things here, the components will change if you change the basis, right? If I suddenly start using spherical coordinates or something like that, of course the components of the vector will start changing. But it's intuitive to think about that the vector should remain the same, right? The vector itself, really the arrow or whatever, it's completely independent of which coordinates I am using. So this is an invariant object. So this guy is an invariant. Whereas the components actually do change if we change, you know, the coordinates. Right? So this is something which is completely independent of coordinates. No matter which coordinates I'm using, I'm still talking about the same arrow, the same vector here. Right? So that's why people like this notation better. But of course, they sort of carry the same information. Either I write this, or I say I'm working in Cartesian coordinates x1, x2, and x3, and the corresponding components are this. All right, so we have this vector field xf, and as I said, this is called Hamiltonian vector field. Corresponding to or generated by F. F, right? So to any phase space function, you know, I can use it. I can write this, and you know, it's a Poisson bracket where I leave one slot open, and that will be the corresponding vector field which you just generated. Okay. Yes.
Can you give us an example of a system and what the Hamiltonian vector field would be, like a very physical system?
You will see. Okay. So you will see very specific examples. You know how to generate these vector fields, and you will see. You know, for example, I'll show you in a minute.
Okay.
But you know, just. Here, I'm just saying, well, for any phase space function, I generate this Hamiltonian vector field. OK, so let's, well, maybe what this do is the picture, right? So we have the P and Q. Of course, the vector field not really lives in the phase space. It lives, you know, tangent space to that phase space. But anyway, so let's imagine we have, like, the vector field, you know, going here. And of course, the vector field is defined everywhere, sort of, you know, on the tangent space of the phase space. So, oh, very good. So now, if the vector field is sufficiently smooth, as is always the case in physics, you should be able to construct the corresponding curves such that the vector field is always tangent to these curves. All right. So now I should be able to draw, you know, a picture like this. So that, you know, well, okay, I should have drawn the curves first. But anyway, so these are the curves, which I'll call integral curves. And they are such that the xf is always tangent to them. Okay. I can just draw the lines such that, you know, at every point, the vector field which I had defined everywhere in the phase space is actually tangent. And, you know, the existence of these curves is, you know, well defined, and you can always construct it. Everybody happy so far? Okay, let's call these curves gamma. Okay. So there will be a one gamma here, there will be another gamma here, another gamma there, and so on. So now, if you have a curve, well, you should be able to specify where on the curve you are. And so you can think about these curves as trajectories, right? So I have a trajectory. Let's say this curve is swept by a motion of a particle in my phase space, right? And so I can characterize where the particle is by specifying at what time we are thinking about it. So this curve will be specified by the corresponding time. And so, you know, at 1 TF, I'll be here, later I'll be there, later I'll be there. So as the TF evolves, then I'm specifying where on that curve I am. Okay. So the TF is the corresponding time variable. Which tells me where on that given curve actually I am, right? And then people write this notation. You may not like it. Don't worry about it. So we have xf, which is, by definition, is just this Poisson bracket of f. Right? So that's what it is. That's our vector field. But sometimes people also write as equal to d over dtf, which basically, you know, evolving along this vector field tells me, well, d over dtf is like a tangent curve to tangent vector to this curve, and at given instant of time, I can write this, right? So d over dtf, like it's a time evolution along these curves, and this is called, you know, time flow along f, right? So isn't this amazing, right? So now we have actually introduced some kind of time flow. We have introduced some kind of curves in the phase space, and everything here is just generated by any function f, right? Okay, so I'm saying time evolution, and I'm saying, you know, all these things, time flow, but of course, time flow typically associated with the Hamiltonian, right? Not with any phase space function. So the question is Hamiltonian any special? And the answer is not really. So you know, the Hamiltonian is just a choice. Of one such phase-based function. Right? So as any phase-based function will generate all these things here, you know, for a given system, I just say, well, one function is special for me, and I will call it a Hamiltonian, and I will give it a special name, h. Right? And so that's just one such choice of my phase-based function. And of course, all this machinery will apply. So this h will, you know, generate the corresponding Hamiltonian vector field. Okay. And it will correspondingly, I can construct these integral curves. And correspondingly, I will have some parameter which describes my curves, where on the curve I am, right? The only, because I'm making this special, so the only exception is that you don't call th the corresponding time, but you just call it t. So that's special because we don't write t of h, but instead we just write t. Okay, so the corresponding time flow is really the time flow we are thinking about, and people just leave out the subscript h, and they just write t. So that's what's special about Hamiltonian, okay? You don't write h. Yes?
Why will the vector be equal to differential of the parameter along that curve?
We're pretending time goes you can think this about this as a differential operator, right? And so the and it corresponds to, so you know, if I have, well, what would this be, right? It would be a tangent vector precisely to a curve parameterized by time tf, right? So this is precisely what I mean by that. It's like a tangent vector. So this thing here that I can write it as d over dtf comes from the fact that, you know, these gammas are integral curves of my tangent vector. So this encodes, you know, the fact that I have a tangent vector.
Yes. Yeah. That's why we
can write. Yes.
Sorry, can you talk a little bit more about, like, I don't know, I remember this from differential geometry, sort of, kind of, but, like, why is a tangent vector a derivative, and how should we be thinking about that?
Why is it d over dtf?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. So, if you have q, right? So then you say, well, q dot is the velocity. Well, what is the velocity? It's a tangent vector to my trajectory q, right? And so this is, of course, dq over dt, right? And it sort of tells me, well, without differential geometry, it's very difficult. But, you know, what vectors are is that vectors actually, basically, you can think about vectors in differential geometry as differential operators. What they do is they take a function, and they map that function to a new function, right? So vector is this thing here. It's a differential operator, d over dt. It takes the q and maps it to a new function, dq over dt. OK.
Okay, all this formulation depends on the thing that we can, like, parameterize f by a new parameterization factor of tf in terms of gamma, right? Like, we're writing it in terms of new integral curves that are, which are our gammas, and it only depends on one tf.
So certainly, so f is a function of q and p.
That's right.
But if I'm on a given curve, I can think about q as a function of t and p as a function of t, right? As I move along that curve, you know, there will be some dependence of q and p. I will be a special dependence because I'm staying on the same curve.
You'll be able to do this parameterization, actually. Like, I don't understand why every function is, like, why we can parameterize every function, every, like, phase space function with only one variable.
But remember, so you know, as you are moving along the t, you always stay on that one curve. Right? So you always stay on this one curve. But of course, your function is defined for other q's and p's as well. But then there will be a corresponding different curve. So in the end, you will actually fill the whole phase space with all the q's and p's everywhere, right? But they will correspond to different curves. So you know, vector field is something which is not defined only on, you know, one point, but it's defined everywhere, right? It's defined everywhere. So I can talk about all q's and p's in my phase space.
I don't really understand how you can find this gamma for, like, every phase space function. Maybe if we see, like, examples, that would be better. Like, how you find this new parameterization, all these integral curves for any function?
No, but look. Yeah. Here, this guy here, it's just a vector field, right?
Yeah, it's okay.
And then, you know, the vector field will be true for any q and p. So really, I can draw this vector field anywhere I want. So I choose q and p, and that will be the corresponding vector field. That will be the corresponding arrow, which you know, points somewhere, right? So the vector field is definitely defined everywhere, and so then I'm maybe asking, well, what do I do with this vector field? And the statement is there's always one curve, you know, going, you know, through each point, which you know is tangent to this vector field. So
maybe some of these curves like cross each other, and
that's also possible. But then you wouldn't have, you know, it wouldn't be smooth there, right? But you know, these crossing points are called caustics, and you can have them. But you know, then you have to deal with them, and there's a way to deal with them.
I'm sorry, but on that point, they can't possibly cross each other if Liouville's theorem is correct, right?
If
Liouville's theorem is correct, they can't possibly cross each other because the volume will be shrinking.
That's right. Yeah. So you have to deal with these. But typically, what happens is that you have only, you know, finite number of them. In the volume and in the whole phase space, right? So you have basically like an infinite dimensional measure, and then you have like few points where something is strange, and you can exclude it from anything.
Sorry, I just maybe Matcha should
Please go ahead.
My question is really like, are there any kind of constraints we have on this general F, this general phase space function? Like, are there just infinite, like, numbers of, like, are there infinitely many phase space functions? Like,
yeah, well, the thing then is that for any phase space function, this will be true, right? I just choose whatever F I choose, right? I choose P squared over 2M, for example.
But how do you
right?
choose that over, say, I mean, how do we know there's going to be extra ones other than the Hamiltonian?
Oh, I can choose, for any system, I can choose P cubed over 2M, right? I can choose anything, right? So the statement is that for any phase space function, this will be true.
But
as long as it is nice and smooth and whatever.
Okay, and then is the vector space like created from that function, and it's not just?
Well, the corresponding vector is precisely constructed from the function.
Oh, okay.
You will see an example. Let me go through the theory first,
okay.
And then I will give you some examples, and then you will construct more examples in today's tutorial. Okay? Yes.
For any general phase space function f, will there always exist a time parameter and an integral curve as well?
Well, okay, it's a good question. So I told you, well, there is this tf which parameterizes my curve, but the question is this tf unique, right? And so can I actually reparameterize something? And because you know how the derivative transforms, if I change the parameter, that tells you how if I change the parameter from tf to tf prime, of course, there will be an extra factor standing here, which be like dtf over dtf prime or something like that. So if I choose to go through my trajectory twice as fast, of course, my time flow is slightly different, right? If I use a clock which goes twice as fast, then this is a vector. It's independent of the parametrization, but how you parameterize, it will have an effect. Okay, so we understand Hamiltonian vector flows and everything. So these are called Hamiltonian vector flows, if you want. So the curves are called Hamiltonian vector flows. All right. So we used the structure of the Poisson bracket to define these vector fields and the flows and everything. But we know that the Poisson bracket has still one open slot here. We can feed something in it, right? That's what we are doing so far. We always like consider the binary operation between two phase space functions, and we fill the other slot. So then, the action of x of f on another phase space function g is defined as follows. So you just take, you act with a vector xf on this g. Well, and it will be defined by your Poisson bracket. What else it would be? So that's a definition. This is what it is. Okay. So this is as we know it. We know it's a new phase space function, right? But using all this terminology over here, well, is the vector field d over dtf, df acting on g. So it's dg over dtf, right? So if I act with this vector field on g, I get how my function g changes along the flow generating by function f. So how g changes along XF or, you know, along the flow generated by F. Okay. So this is just a new meaning of this Poisson bracket. It's just a Poisson bracket as you know it, but you are really, you know, describing how G changes along this new time flow. Okay. If it doesn't flow, something special happens, right? If I move along the time flow TF and the value of the G stays the same, well, it's a special situation. G does not change along this time flow. And it's called that this time flow is a symmetry of G. So definition if dG over dTF is equal to 0, then you say that the flow is a symmetry. Of G. So that's the definition. So now we know what a symmetry means. It means that, you know, something doesn't change. So what it means is, again, the picture, right? I have P and Q. I have the corresponding flows generated by my function f. And then, you know, I look at the value g has at this time, and I look at, and I evolve along the curve later on, and I look at the values at g at some later time, tf, and of course they are the same, so we have a symmetry. Okay, happy times. We have a symmetry. Okay, so everybody happy with this? It's just a definition. But what else it would be, right? So now, if you are happy with this, we can formulate this most beautiful version of the Noether's theorem. And so let me do it. So Noether's theorem. Again. But now it'll be version
three.
Version three.
Four.
Is it? Hamiltonian version. But let me stress Hamiltonian beautiful version. Okay. And it goes as follows. So let there be a symmetry of Hamiltonian generated by the flow of I. That means, okay, flow of I. But, you know, there's some phase space function I. There's a corresponding xi, the vector field, is the corresponding curve gamma I, right? So flow of I gamma I. Then I is an integral of motion. Okay. So as the statement, so we have a symmetry of the Hamiltonian, or Hamiltonian H, generated by flow of I, then I is an integral of motion. Yes?
Sorry, can we
jump back for a bit?
Yes.
I don't understand why G1 is equal to G2. Because
so that's the definition by what do you mean by symmetry? So you know, in general, G1 and G2 will be very different, right? So if I take any G, you know, so I fix F, right? I fix F and it gives me these curves, right? And then I'm asking, you know, are there any phase space functions for which this is special flow, right? And so sometimes you can find these, you know, special functions which are such that, you know, they do not change along these flows. And then you say, well, these are special functions because they have a symmetry. So we have a symmetry, right? But in general, there won't be any symmetry. And of course, all the phase space functions will typically change along any flow, right? But sometimes it happens that some of them do not.
Yeah, because if there are different points in phase space,
yes.
How can it still be
symmetric? Oh, an example is an energy, right? So let's say I have, that's a stupid example, but anyway, momentum, right? So let's say my Hamiltonian is independent of the corresponding position, right? So I have a conserved momentum. So certainly, if I move along the trajectories, then the momentum remains the same. So the value of the momentum stays the same, right? But it's only in case when I have a symmetry.
Sorry, maybe this is silly, but I don't quite see why F is preserved under its own flow.
What do you think?
But I get the Poisson derivative of F with F is zero.
Exactly. yeah, exactly. Now, sort of F defines the flow, right? So it cannot, you define the flow by considering F. So really, you know, whatever you move there, sort of, as you transport F, was already there because it's precisely by definition generated by F.
But maybe my mental picture that's not working is that maybe that works in one dimension, but like if you had multiple Qs or Ps, then like you'd have several different, like you'd have a subnormal that you're living on that is of dimension greater than one, and then you have to pick which direction to go there, and the vector field should pick out one direction to go. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, I don't know. So the simplest answer, the Poisson bracket of F with F is zero, right? And the more complicated one is that, you know, what this Poisson bracket is doing is sort of doing a gradient of F, right? So if I just do, well, this is very naive, right? But if I do this, you can think about it as a gradient of F, right? So now if I feed another F here, then it will look like this. So the question is, why is this zero? And the answer is because this gradient is special. It's the symplectic gradient, which actually is anti-symmetric or something like that. But you know, really, what this gradient F you know, defines is, you know, I define the curve, so I in terms of the gradient of F, right? So this is my gradient of F. And then as I move along these things, somehow you know, if I consider this point to that point, well, how do I get here? So the F defines me how to get from here to there, but it defines in such a way is that, of course, that, you know, it's already fixed how do I do that. And so when I moved there, it was already how it was defined, basically, there, right? So the difference between, you know, if I transport something else from here to there, I can get something new, right? But if I transport F to that point, you know, this point was precisely defined due to F. And come on, it doesn't make any sense what I'm saying, okay? Yes?
So I think the version of the Deleuze theorem implies that H is always an integral motion.
No. So there's an assumption, let there be a symmetry of Hamiltonian H. There may not be, right?
The Poisson bracket of H and H is always zero, so.
That's true.
That's only true if H doesn't depend explicitly on time.
Yeah. So you know, what I'm here, I'm throwing away this, you know, time-dependent terms. So I'm just considering the Poisson bracket part, but not dH over dt. And that could spoil that if you have time-dependent system.
Translation symmetry.
Yeah.
Okay, so when we take dg dtf, right, we're taking like a directional derivative of g, right, with along the flow.
Exactly.
But so why is that being zero? Like, you'd think that would be zero at a very specific point. Like, if we had, or I guess a part of the function, you know, we'd have a part of this, kind of like, you know, when you have like a function with like a flat slope, the derivative is zero there. But here, we're saying when g1 equals g2, it's a symmetry. But why does that relate back to saying like the directional derivative is zero at some point?
Well, well, this is a definition of the symmetry, right? So definition, I have a symmetry of G if this G does not change along this flow, right? But that's not true for every G. And sometimes you cannot find any G, but you know, sometimes you have these very, very special Gs which do not change along this flow.
Okay, so say maybe G1 doesn't change along the flow and G2 doesn't change along the flow. So I guess they're both equal to zero, so. Maybe.
Sure, it can be equal to zero, but that would be trivial, right?
Say they weren't equal to zero. Why does them being equal to each other? Because like the whole part in between isn't. I mean, I guess okay.
No. What does a conservation means, right? If I have a momentum here and I have a wall to particle, and let's say the momentum is conserved, right? It means that the value of the momentum is equal to here, all these points. The value of the momentum is the same, right, along the flow. And this is precisely what it means. Like, if you consider G3 here, it will still be equal to, right? Also, so it's like along the whole flow, right, the value does not change.
There's an interval of the flow on which the directional derivative of G with respect to df does not change?
Yeah.
So you parameterize the flow with respect to f, and you realize that if dg dtf, or the Poisson bracket of that with f, is equal to zero, flow is a symmetry of g. But at the same time, if you replace their roles, they would get you would get df dtg is equal to zero, which means that the flow is a symmetry of f. So is there a sort of are there two different symmetries, are they independent, and you would get two symmetries out of one, or they're just somehow interrelated?
Okay, very good. So what you just did is that you proved my Noether's theorem. Okay, so let's write it down, okay? Perfect. No, this is great. So you did all the work for me. So, you know, we have a symmetry. This is what you just said, right? We have a symmetry of H. So, you know, that's the assumption of the theorem, right? So what does it mean? It means that Hi, which is dH over dTf, is equal to zero. So that's the assumption of the theorem, right? This is what you just said. Right? I have the H does not change along the time flow along the flow generated by I, okay? But you said by anti-symmetry, right? But you know, we know that the Poisson bracket is anti-symmetric, so this must be also true. Right? Because IH is minus HI. Right, but what is this? This is just how my I changes with respect to the time evolution generated by H, right? So in other words, I has to be an integral of motion. We are done. Isn't this beautiful? It's the simplest ever, you know, proof of the Noether's theorem. And yeah, it is what it is, right? Just by antisymmetry of the Poisson bracket, we have shown Noether's theorem. But beware, right? So this is super simple here. But what does it mean, right? What does it mean? And that's what we are wondering here. And that is actually non-trivial, right? So we have P and Q. And then by assumption, we have the flows generated by I, okay? And then we are saying, well, let there be a symmetry. So it means that as I move along the flow of I, H1 will be equal to H2. And similarly, you know, I have some gamma I prime here. And then we'll have H1 prime. And then as I move along this, H2 prime. So H1 prime is equal to H2 prime, right? So as I move along these gamma I curves, it doesn't change. OK, very good. So that's the assumption. But what is the statement then? Is that, well, aha, but if I have the corresponding time evolution, OK? So time evolution corresponds to, so this is my gamma, which is gamma of h, right? If I have some time evolution, and then I look at the value of the constant here, I1, and I look at some later value, I2, well, let me use the same point. It will be many things, but anyway, so I1 and then I2 here, then these will be equal. And you know, this is a little bit non-trivial, right? It's precisely captured in this, you know, commutator or the Poisson bracket, is that, you know, so I know that this is the symmetry, so if I evolve H, it doesn't change. But that the fact that it implies that if I have true time evolution gamma generated by H, that the value of I does not change is highly non-trivial. Right? And that's what your friend is wondering. Right? But we just proved it here. Okay? And it's fact that, you know, you have sort of like this closed square, and then, you know, you can move this way and that way, and it gives you the same thing as going this way and that way, which is the standard way of defining commutator and stuff like that. Precisely what the Poisson bracket basically, you know, does for you. Yes?
I know this is a classical measure, but in quantum mechanics, it's non-zero. Does that mean that when you time evolve something and there is a symmetry, it gains a phase instead of just being zero?
So you're asking if it's not zero, the commutator?
Yes.
Oh, in, for example, P and Q or whatever.
Yeah. Well, like in quantum mechanics, the commutation relation is always I H bar.
Yeah.
But that's like a symmetry.
So yeah, once you start breaking these things geometrically, you know, means strange things, right? So if you don't close on these things, then yeah.
It's like you can transport something in time, but it won't be exactly the same. It'll gain.
Yeah. So giving a geometrical, I think it can be done, but just go beyond what I know. But I'm sure it can be done. That you can still formulate some geometrical things. All right. So, yes?
Back to DJ's question, like, what if I is it? And what if I is explicitly dependent on time?
Okay, let's consider time independent at this point, right? So I was warning you at the beginning, right? But I always crossing this explicit time dependence here. Sorry. But of course, if it did, then yeah, we need to add, only you are interested in the total time derivative of I, right? So there will be a partial di over dt term as well. That cannot entirely be expressed in terms of the Poisson brackets, and it will be more complicated.
Also, the statement of Noether's theorem, will it work if capital I is equal to capital H?
If capital I is equal to capital H?
Like, H will always be a symmetry generated by flow of H.
Yes, of course, by the antisymmetry of the Poisson brackets.
Mean H is always
because it's time independent, then H is always conserved, right? So if you want to deal with the time dependence, you actually have to, and you want to give this a geometrical meaning, you have to enlarge your phase space into a contact space, and you have to include time as another independent coordinate, and then everything becomes more complicated. But it can be done. So if you want to deal with time dependence, that's okay. All right, so the last thing I want to do here about the symmetries is to puzzle you with a word which is called hidden symmetries. Okay, and So how to arrive at this? Well, sometimes phase space has an additional structure. So we have been discussing that, you know, phase space is just, you know, two-dimensional space which depends on Q and P's. There's these canonical transformations which, you know, in generally mix Q and P's together. We cannot distinguish Q's from P's. But sometimes you actually build your phase space as a cotangent space over some configuration space. So you really start with some configuration space where you know what the Q's are, and you build the phase space on top of that. Right? And so you say, well, for these given Q's, I add another additional space which has P's, but I can distinguish P's from Q's. Okay? So e.g., we have a phase space as a phase space as a cotangent bundle. Let's just use this word, T star of C over configuration space. Okay, so we have some, you know, base configuration space. So this is my manifold where my motion happens. So this is a manifold. You have a motion in that manifold. But on top of that, for each, you know, so this is my motion there. So this would be like Q of t here. But for each of these, I also have an extra space where the p's live. P's live here. And so then the whole phase space consists of, you know, not only the Q's where the particle is, but also of the P's. The P's lives in this extra space here. All right. And you know, why I can distinguish configuration space from the rest is that typically the configuration space is equipped with some additional structure like the metric. So we have the Euclidean metric here around us. And so that tells us, you know, how to measure distances between the queues, right? So configuration space, and this is typically equipped with metric. And so that's really, you know, the metric tells me how to measure distances between queues, but it doesn't tell me how to measure distances between p's, right? So of course, now people consider extensions of this, and you can consider the metric which acts on both Q's and P's. But then you are, you know, this is very, it's an extended theory, right? Anyway, so a person to talk to would be Laurent here, so who has, you know, written many papers about this, you know, Finsler geometry where you have G as a function of both Q and P and whatever. You can measure distances between P's and. And it's nice and symmetric, and then, you know, that's the true Hamiltonian mechanics. Here we are sort of, you know, breaking the symmetry of Hamiltonian mechanics. If we have this, if we can distinguish the configuration space, then of course the canonical transformations will be crazy because they are mixing Q and P's, but I cannot do that anymore. I can only mix Q's between themselves and P's independently, right? But I cannot mix Q's with P's because I already know what the configuration space is and what the Q's are. Yes?
Give us sort of an example of, like, I don't know, what would have this sort of phase space versus what would have this phase space?
I would say that everything here, everything we know, we probably is described by this.
So nothing we know is described by this?
Well, this still applies, right? This still applies.
Okay,
but the general, the transformations, canonical transformations, will be only allowed to, you know, mix Q's, for example, not mix Q's with P's.
Is this just another way of formulating it?
It's a special case. This is a special case. So you know, so far, this was completely general and innate to Hamiltonian mechanics. At this point, you are breaking the symmetry of Hamiltonian mechanics. You are introducing a special subspace of my phase space, which we say this is the Q space.
Why are we doing that?
Because that's our everyday experience, right? You don't see things p's, mixing q's and p's, right? You typically, observers do agree in, like, you know, what is the position of the particle, and then the other observers doesn't say, well, it's a position and the momentum of the particle. Well, anyway, so this is the standard thing which we observe. Probably how nature works, right? Maybe not.
Just because, like, you can't observe both the position and momentum at the same time, is that why? The infinite position, is that why? Because, like, macroscopically, everything has, like, a position and momentum, so.
So, you know, everybody knows how to measure a distance from this point to that point, right? But now if I tell you, well, actually, the distance depends on the momentum somehow. I don't know. Well, it does in special relativity. Yeah. That's a different thing. Okay. Anyway, so if this is the case, so then there exists so-called canonical projection. Exists. So this canonical projection is called pi. Well, it's a map, pi. And what this pi does is that it maps q's and p's into the just q's. So it basically kills all the p's and just leaves you out what the p is. So namely, you know, if I have a system over here at this point, and this point is characterized by some q and p, well, it tells me, well, let's forget about this additional extra structure p, and let's just map it down to the configuration space to q. So it maps basically like phase space to configuration space. But as you will learn in general relativity, once you have a map between the coordinates, you also have between the cotangent space and the manifold itself, then you also have a map between induced map between vectors and tensors and so on. So this induces an induced map. Map by star, which maps, you know, various tensors. And let me just write it for vectors. So pi star, it will map my xf or xi to x tilde I. This is my vector field on the phase space. And this will be some vector field which does not know about the p space. Okay, so vector field only in q direction. Very vaguely, what it is? Only in q direction. Explicitly. So if I apply this thing here on xi, so this xi will have components in q and p, right? So that's our former definition over there. So it's the first line ever there. So this is the pi star acting on this thing I. Okay, so it's pi star acting on di over dp, d over dqi, and minus di over dqi, d over dpi, right? So that's what our xi is. And then what this pi star does is basically it just, you know, leaves the q directions there, and it kills this p direction there. Okay, so this is equal to, so it kills that, and we are just left with di over the pi d over the qi. So this is how it works. Okay? Yes? It's called canonical projection. It has nothing to do with the canonical Hamilton's equations. It has nothing to do. It's just a, it's called canonical projection. I don't know why. Let's just call it a projection. Okay, it just projects you know, Qs and Ps to Qs, but it also can, you know, be extended to work on vector fields and stuff like that. And basically what it does is it kills everything which depends on P, like the P direction and stuff like that.
So with this projection, we are back to the configuration space. Is it different from the Lagrangian formalism, or is it equivalent in some sense?
Okay, very good. So let me continue here, and it will partly answer your question. Okay, very good. So this is how it is defined. Okay, just, you know, once you learn a little bit of geometry and relativity and stuff like that, you will see this thing here. Okay, very good. So now definition. Okay. So now definition. Before I do the definition, let me just introduce a shorthand for this thing here. Let me call it x tilde I of I. Okay? Well, that's what it is, right? X tilde I of I. So now we have two options. X tilde I of I is either function of Q only. Of Q only. So then the corresponding symmetry which we have due to the integral I is called an explicit symmetry. And you know, this thing over here precisely defines a vector field on the in the QI direction. Defines a vector field on the configuration space. So then we have a vector on configuration space okay, and because we have vector on configuration space, the corresponding symmetry is seen on the configuration space. I can really see, you know, I do a translation and then this is a symmetry, right? So vector field on configuration space corresponds to visible symmetry, and this is called isometry by definition. Okay. The other possibility is that this x tilde I is a function of both Q and P, function of both Q and a P. But then that's a disaster, right? Because, you know, what I've got here seems like a vector space on the configuration space. But if it's dependent on P, well, what the hell P means on the configuration space? I have no idea, right? On the configuration space, I only know what the Qs are, right? But if I have P's as well, what do I do, right? So it's a disaster. No, it could, right? But this is a disaster. And then the corresponding symmetry is, you know, the vector field is on the configuration space, but it doesn't mean anything there because it's dependent on P, right? So I have no way to interpret what it means. For different P's, it will be something different, right? So means that I have the symmetry is invisible on the configuration space because it will be P dependent. So I cannot see it, right? And so symmetry is invisible. Symmetry invisible on configuration space, and that's why it's called this symmetry is called hidden symmetry. Hidden symmetry, or sometimes it's called dynamical symmetry. Okay. So we have, you know, these two possibilities. Yes? Okay, I'll show you in a minute.
Another question. What if the mapping worked in a way that the vector was mapped to zero? I mean, if I was not a function of p.
Okay. Well, then definitely you cannot discover that symmetry by looking at the configuration space. So if the flow is non-trivial in the phase space, but if it projects down to the configuration space and it's zero, it means it's entirely like in the p direction, sort of, right? And so it's completely hidden. You don't see anything on the configuration space.
But what is the difference between that case and this case right here?
Because yeah, so I would still say it's a hidden symmetry. So, you know, we have these two type symmetries, those which we see on the configuration space and those which we don't see on the configuration space. Okay? And so these which we don't see are called dynamical or.
In this particular case, you had a function of p in the direction of q, which was kind of strange in the configuration space. But in what I was saying, it's kind of the same, probably, because. You're seeing that in the direction of q, you have nothing. It's zero, so it's probably in the direction of p. But I think somehow there should be a little difference. Why are they the same?
No, they are not the same, right? But they still carry the same name, hidden symmetry. Yeah, they are not the same, of course. But you would just call, you know, you would include both cases into the hidden symmetry because, you know, anything that you can see on the configuration space is an explicit symmetry. I look at the system around myself, and I see, you know, it's obviously, you know, axis symmetry or there's obvious spherical symmetry or whatever. I see that symmetry in the configuration space as I look around, right? And so in that case, I would say, well, there's a corresponding flow, and it's an isometry. But sometimes it happens that the system does not have that kind of symmetry. I cannot see any geometrical symmetry around myself. But nevertheless, there is an integral of motion, and there is a corresponding symmetry in the phase space. But I don't see that corresponding symmetry in the phase space. I just see the configuration space, and I cannot discover it on the configuration space. It's hiding from me. It's a dynamical symmetry. Why dynamical? Because I only see that symmetry after I know how the particle actually evolves, how the system evolves in time. Right. If the system evolves nicely, there will be the corresponding integral of motion, and I will see, and there will be a symmetry which I discover by studying the dynamics of the system. But I cannot see the symmetry by looking around myself, around the geometry of the configuration space. So this is an extension of Noether's theorem, as you know it probably, because you know in Noether's theorem, typically they say, well, look around yourself, look around the configuration space. If you can see a symmetry, well, then you have an integral of motion. But sometimes you don't see a symmetry, and nevertheless, there is an integral of motion. Because the whole thing works on the phase space rather than only on the configuration space.
Shouldn't we be able to like break this dependence on both Q and P by a good canonical transformation?
Okay, very good. If you could do the general canonical transformations, you couldn't distinguish, you know, isometries from hidden symmetries because everything would be mixed together and everything is just one kind of symmetry.
That's right, but I can maybe translate these hidden symmetries to an isometry, something like that. That if I move to
if you could do full canonical transformations, you would be able to, you know, there won't be any you know, the two cases. It will be just one case, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. But it's only when you can actually distinguish the configuration space. There's a distinction between the two. But it seems to be the case which it actually happens in the nature. So that's why we are interested in this. Okay, but maybe not. Maybe really the phase space is actually a phase space, and you cannot break it into the configuration space and something.
Like if you're sorry, I don't know quite how it works, but if your system is fully integrable, then you can switch to like only action and angle coordinates, and then would that mean that you only have visible symmetries?
Well. Yes and no. I would say no. And then we can discuss more. Okay. So what I want to stress here is that this is a genuine symmetry. Symmetry of phase space. Which cannot be seen on the configuration space. Okay. So now Okay, let's leave this here. You were asking about the energy a lot of questions last time, and I kept telling you the energy is special. Well, it's because the energy is not a normal symmetry as we know it. It's a hidden symmetry. Okay?
So here we started from the point that we assume that every function that we have is just a function of Q and P.
Yes.
What if someone says that it's actually not that? It's also a function of, let's say, the momentum of momentum. So we have it's a function of three things, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So why aren't we considering that and just rewriting?
You can. Of course you can. So you know, either you can go to higher derivative theories.
So the symmetries would be even hidden in the phase space. There would be some symmetry.
Yeah. So then you would have much more. Of course. But you know, so there's very many ways how you can extend Hamiltonian mechanics. One way is that you say, well, indeed, I can start including higher, you know, derivatives and so on. That's one way. Another way is that you say, well, I don't really like that my time is generated by one phase space function only, by h. What if my dynamics is defined by two functions, or three functions, or five functions? I need five functions to specify what the system means. Then you move to number mechanics, right? And so that's an amazing theory. And then you can, you know, start considering phase spaces which are not two n dimensional, but they have, let's say, three n dimensional or five n dimensional or whatever. You can extend all these things to more complicated cases, and all of the properties of the Hamiltonian mechanics sort of still work. So it's a mystery of nature why you need to specify only one function and you know, have two n-dimensional phase space so that it describes nature. And we don't know, right? So there are generalizations of Hamiltonian mechanics, as you're saying. Anyway, so let me give you a sort of trivial example. Example of a hidden symmetry. Okay. And for this, we consider just the energy of a free particle, v squared over 2m, energy. And we know that the energy for the free particle is conserved. Okay. So this better be a constant motion. Of course it is. So now, you know, let's go through this procedure and let's see what kind of symmetry this is, right? So the first step was, well, if we want to decide what kind of symmetry we have, and it's hiding here, then the first step is, well, we have this canonical projection, but we first have to calculate what is the corresponding vector field to the energy E, and then we project it down to the configuration space and see what happens. All right, so the first step is to calculate the corresponding Hamiltonian vector field, so XE, okay. So it's DE over DP, D over DQI, DE over DP, D over DQ, minus DE over DQ, D over DP, okay. So now E does not depend on Q, it's just a function of P. So this guy is gone. So this is zero. Zero crossed. All right. And then D over DP is just something like P over M. So this is equal to P over M, D over DQ. Okay. So that's the flow in the phase space, which corresponds to quantity E. Yes.
In order to do this and sort of look for these hidden symmetry things, is it a requirement that we have the cotangent bundle?
In order to distinguish the two types of symmetries, yes, basically.
So does that come from the fact that the dE by dQ is zero, or is it some separate structure?
No. So, you could have some, you know, more non-trivial integrals of motions which do depend on Q, right? So that could happen. right? And you could still say it's an explicit symmetry or hidden symmetry or whatever. So in our case, I'm just considering the simplest possible example of a hidden symmetry, right? Does that answer your question? Not really.
When you want to map it to the configuration space, it's just an identity map, because here you don't have the DDDP.
Exactly. Perfect. Well, we are getting ahead of ourselves, right? So then what we want to do is that we want to calculate the canonical projection. And what the canonical projection does is that it will kill the p direction. Well, there is no p direction here, right? So this is just equal to p over m over dq, right? So this is the guy which we are after, right? So this is whatever we called xe. In this case, there's only one q. So xe tilde something, xe. Okay, and then we are asking, well, is this q dependent or is it p dependent? Right? Obviously depends on p. So x e tilde depends on p. So this guy over here is not a nice vector field which depends only on q's. Right? So this is a hidden symmetry. Yes?
What if your Hamiltonian is just position dependent potential energy? Does it?
Well, you will see an example, don't worry. you will do an example in today's tutorial. Yes?
Symmetry is a lot more common than the other ones, just the visible symmetries.
The answer is no. Typically, you have many more explicit symmetries, okay. But some nice systems have some nice hidden symmetries.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you give an example of what an explicit symmetry is?
I'll give it in a moment. So anyway, so here we have just concluded this is a hidden symmetry. Does it make sense or not? Well. Is energy hidden or is it explicit? If I look at my configuration space of free particle, I see, you know, the configuration space 3x1, x2, x3, they are all homogeneous and nice and whatever, isotropic. Then is it obvious that there would be conserved energy? If I I'm looking at the configuration space. The configuration space is at an instant of time, right? But in an instant of time, do I see that there is a time independence? I don't see it, right? I see just isotropic space at a given instant of time. I would see an isotropic space later as well. But for that, I need to know what is the time evolution, right? So I need to know what the dynamics of the system is. I know only after I know that the particle actually, you know, there's a time translation symmetry, then I know the energy would be conserved. But you know that precisely corresponds to dynamical symmetry or hidden symmetry. Right? Because energy is very, very different. So this is, you know, makes sense. Because only after I consider time evolution, I see the symmetry. I see the time translation symmetry. Symmetry, which is not a symmetry of the configuration space. And that's why this is hidden or dynamical. Right? It's a hidden symmetry. So energy is very, very different, integral of motion, than, for example, the momentum. For the momentum I see, I can move in the x direction, nothing changes. But for energy, I have to move in time. So that's like moving out of the configuration space, right? Or evolving configuration space. So all this actually makes sense. So that was a trivial example. Now, a non-trivial one, which you will study in your tutorial today. And that's, of course, the motion in the spherically symmetric potential. So motion in spherical very Kali symmetric potential. And in particular, we'll specify later to the Kepler problem. And the Kepler problem is simply characterized by the force, which looks like some constant r square r hat. This is a unit vector here. Okay, so the Kepler problem is a specific example of the spherical symmetric potential, which has this, you know, 1 over r squared dependence here, right? And OK, very good. So you will play with this problem. So now, before we, you know, let's spoil the problem, OK? Let's spoil the tutorial. How many obvious explicit integrals of motions do we have? Do we have any symmetries of the configuration space? What are the symmetries?
Angular momentum.
Angular momentum, perfect. So we have, you know, spherical symmetry. So there will be angular momentums conserved, corresponding to. Do we have some other symmetry? We have some trivial hidden symmetry.
Time translation.
So the energy will be conserved. Do we have anything else? Obviously.
Did you say you have radial symmetry or not?
That would be part of the spherical symmetry, sort of.
Oh, okay.
Because if you move radially away, of course the force changes, right? So what you can do is that you can rotate the system, but you cannot move away from the system because that wouldn't be a symmetry, right? So we have these integrals of motion. This is the explicit, because we see the symmetry there. This is the trivial hidden. Okay. And so you might think this is it. But already in the 18th century, people knew that this is not it. And there is an additional, actually three integrals of motion, which are hidden from you. And these are called Laplace-Runge-Lenz vector. And you probably have that. I'm running out of time. This is good. There we go. So there, however, exists. There is additional hidden symmetry. Symmetry. This is called Laplace, because Laplace discovered it. Runge-Lenz vector.
Middle name?
Runge. I don't know how to. R-U-N-G-E. I don't know how to pronounce it. Lens vector. Okay. By the way, if you read Feynman's lectures on celestial mechanics or something like that, he pretends, well, he probably doesn't know. He's a genius. So he really derives the existence of this vector. He basically starts with some geometry, and he pulls out of the head this vector, which I'll just write down here. And then from there, he derives Kepler motion and everything. Right? So he probably didn't know that this is a hidden symmetry or whatever. Anyway, so this vector A is written as P times L. So that's the momentum, the angular momentum. And then minus M is the mass of the particle, which we are thinking about. This is the same K as for the force, and R hat is this thing. And so the statement is this guy here is an integral of motion. It's a vector, so three integrals of motion. And it's conserved during time. Okay. So what is the geometrical meaning? We know motion, well, the solution of the Kepler problem, we have an ellipse, right? So we have motion like this. And then you can look at, let's say, this point here. So then you can consider the term, which is, well, the momentum is in this direction. The angular momentum is all around. So P cross L is this thing here. That's the vector like that. And then the vector, which goes like mkr hat, is this vector, And if you add them together, you get your vector A, which is conserved. So similarly, for example, at this point, you would have mkr hat here, and then you would have E times L here, and the whole thing would give you A, and this A better be the same as that one, although this one looks smaller. Okay? Okay, and similarly, you know, here you would have A, and here you would have A, and they all remain the same along the trajectory. Okay? This is one focus, this is another focus. All right, so that's the geometrical meaning of that. And yeah, you have this, you know, and you will check in your tutorial today that this is indeed a hidden symmetry. It's not seen in the configuration space whatsoever. You just see, you know, the spherical symmetry of the problem, but you don't see any additional symmetry. And you know, this is an example of the phase space symmetry. By the way, just to complete what I want to say is that, you know, so we have integrals E, L, and A. So it seems this like 6 plus 1 is like 7. But we have system with 3 degrees of freedom. So the phase space is 6-dimensional. It seems like a lot of integrals of motion. And the truth is that not all of them are independent. And so we have two constraints with these integrals. And so one of them is that A times L is equal to 0. That's one scalar constraint. Another constraint is that this thing A square is M square A square plus 2 M E L square. And so we have two constraints. So in so we have only 7 minus 2, which is 5 independent integrals of motion. Okay. So that's good. I told you last time that the maximum number of integrals of motion you can have, which are independent, is actually 2n minus 1. That's the maximum number ever you can ever think about. Well, for n equal to 3, this is 5. So this is precisely what we have. Okay. So now, because you have so many integrals of motion, you are very lucky and the system is special. We will see in the next lecture, probably not, that in order to call the system completely integrable, you need n integrals of motion. So if we had n, then the system would be completely integrable. Well, n nice ones, completely integrable. So that would be 3 for us. So if you had 3 nice integrals of motion, the system would already be integrable. It turns out that we have 5. We have 2 more. Okay, so we have super integrable system. So we have super integrable. So whenever you have, you know, more than n, the system is already super integrable. If you had 4, you would have superintegrable. But we have 5, which is the maximum number, 2n minus 1. It's maximally superintegrable. What it means is that you can actually integrate it algebraically. You don't need to do any integrals, sort of, if you are clever enough. And that's what you will do in some courses, I guess. So really, people know how to solve a couple of problems. But the reason why you can do it is that it is more than integrable. It is actually maximally superintegrable.
Just now you said that momentum is a explicit symmetry. But if you take the definition of the x vector field, it's del over del p. So momentum should just like that. The x vector field with momentum should just be 0. dependent on k.
So okay, very good. So you have another integral of motion, which is the momentum. So this is my another integral of motion, p equal to p, right? If you calculate what that is, so let's see. So we have to calculate dp over dp. So xp is just one.
Yeah.
Well, d over dq, one, right? And so the canonical projection. So now you look at what stands here, which is the one. Is it p dependent? Obviously, it's not. It's a q dependent thing. It's a constant, right? So this will be an explicit symmetry.
Just now,
what if it's just a constant? Well, constant is not a function of p, right? So it will be an explicit symmetry.
It's also not a function of q.
Well, it is a special function of q.
Oh, I see. Okay.
If we had a general system that's like horribly complicated, let's say, is there a way of a system to find the phase space symmetries so that we can find the hidden symmetries and then we can solve the system?
The answer is no. The answer is no. And the most powerful method, which turned out historically in this respect, is the Hamilton-Jacobi method. So by playing with the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, sometimes you can discover nice integrals of motion, which are the hidden symmetries rather than the explicit symmetries. But of course, there is no general procedure how to do that.
Here we have some conserved quantities that are like vector-like, but we are proving that they are conserved, proving that each component is conserved. Because in our setup, we are taking g functions that are always scalar functions. But is there a way to reproduce this, but for any tensor-like quantity, like the symmetry definition?
So here you're exactly right. So I'm saying, well, there's this vector conserved, but what I really mean by that is that each component of the vector is conserved. And similarly, you would say that for the tensor, right? So you would have like each component of the tensor would be conserved. Like the fact that you can, group these together to form a vector is an additional extra bonus which you are getting, right? But the question is how many actually integrals of motion you really have.
Yeah, that way I understand it. But what I mean is, would it be like a geometrical meaning, like a geometrical way of trying to explain that a not non-scalar quantity is conserved? Like, would we write for scalars?
I don't know what geometrical meaning you mean, but the answer is generally not. Generally not. There won't be any geometrical meaning. It is a symmetry of the phase space, but it's always a symmetry of the phase space. So it has always nice geometrical meaning in the phase space, but whether it has some interesting nice geometrical meaning in configuration space, no. Yes?
I don't know if this is quite the same question, but is there ever a system where you can get something neat and tensorial out?
I don't know. I don't know. Last thing I wanted to say here is that we have L that has commutation relations of L. Then we have A, which has commutation relations of L as well. If you add the two together, it's like SU2, SU2 representation. So what you are pulling out of the hat is SO4 here. So actually, the Kepler motion, you can think about it as all the symmetries of a free motion on the three sphere. OK, let me finish with this.